Hi, this is Eric Spady, and welcome to the Hidden Treasure Ministry podcast. We hope this podcast blesses you today, and we would love to hear from you. Please visit our website at www.hiddentreasureministry.com. And now here's today's podcast.
Degree in missions and Bible, and we were planning to go out as missionaries, and we had gone to a short-term team in Sweden and fell in love. So we came back, made a three-year commitment, and what was interesting was within the first couple of years, the Lord spoke to my husband's heart when he was out for a walk, saying, someday you'll be the leader here. And within, I think, 5 years, he was the director of that ministry. So it was just interesting how the Lord had prepared him for it. At the time, it seemed utterly ridiculous. But within a few years, we found there's a rule in YWAM. The last one standing gets to be the leader. If you stay long enough, everyone else comes and goes. Eventually, you get promoted. So we went through a real crisis there shortly after the crisis started before we took leadership, but we went through almost financial bankruptcy. So we lived on the edge of it for several years as a ministry. So we learned a lot about trauma and stress during those years. And my husband was a real rock. He was committed to staying and obeying God no matter what. And it really did something to our faith that sometimes terrible things happen, even when you're doing everything right and you're walking in obedience. That, I think, became a real foundation for the way we approached life, because so often we blame people when things go wrong, not realizing sometimes this is the way it's supposed to be. We just didn't know it was supposed to look like that. So I've seen my husband in leadership in all sorts of different situations, and the Lord has prepared his heart for this ministry for years. Been taking care of people pastorally since we were teenagers. We've been doing that, I think. As he was going to Bible college, he was a youth leader. And what I love about Eric's heart is his meekness. He is a real picture of somebody who's highly competent, highly skilled, and yet he is meek. He is teachable. He is humble. He is aware of his faults, and he is willing to learn. And that has been such a picture of Jesus to me, and it has allowed me the room to become humble and give up some of my pride because he made it safe for me to admit I was wrong. So this is the man I want to introduce you to. I've left out all the bad parts, just so you know.
I take the rest of the teaching.
This is the edited version, the affirming version. We've been through hard stuff too that really, shaped us and taught us these things he's going to teach you. So I'd like to just pray for my husband. So Lord, I thank you for this man of God that I have had the joy of sharing this life with. I thank you for what you have deposited in him, how much of your image he carries. Lord, I ask that you would speak through him now, that he would be able to express what is on his heart that you have put there, and that your words would flow. Lord, we open our hearts to receive from you tonight. I ask that you would highlight what is for each one of us individually, and we would feel your voice speaking to us through Eric. Thank you, Jesus. Amen.
Thanks, Annie. Well, I'm glad to be able to teach you the things that's really on my heart with family dynamics. So we're on page 6 of your notes, in case you didn't catch that. So you can turn there on your notes to your notes with me. Right before lunch, we're going to share a little bit more about our ministry very shortly, what Hidden Treasure is, what it's about, some of our training and background that both Lisa and I have received through a very special school in Denmark, and I believe the organization is the only one in the world that is a Christian counseling school that specializes in sexual abuse. Lots of Christian counseling schools, but this is the only one that really has a heart and focus on the sexually abused. So I'm about to graduate this summer. Yay. Lisa just, no, not just, passed 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And Reba's doing the school. Sharon, who's our hostess and running around with camera, just walked that way, is doing the school. Sharon's part of our board. I was combining two things. Sharon's part of our board of Hidden Treasure. Tom Cole's part of our board. And Joy Paulson, Lisa's aunt, is also taking the school. So, and then Gita, I'm going to introduce later on. She helped, was one of the people that helped found that. So you'll hear a little bit more about that. And we want to give you a chance to sow a little seed, if you would be willing to, and if the Lord puts that on your heart, to a special project we have going on in India. I'll introduce Gita a little bit later, and she and I have really connected over Greenland, where sexual abuse is just off the scale, off the charts, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later this afternoon. But in India, it's just about as bad. And the level of ministry that's needed there is astronomical. So we've been a part of a project for several years now, training up pastors, lay workers, all sorts of different people from all over India in this school that Lisa and I and many others have been a part of and have taught. And so we want to give you an opportunity to sow a little seed into India later on right before lunch. But I wanted to tell you that because part of my little introduction for Family Dynamics is we have to know what's real before we can find out what's false. And a great example of this is one of our India students called me up, I don't know, about 3 months ago and says, somebody gave me $1 million. Could you help me cash it? Okay, automatically I was suspicious and I'm like, what is that? And anyway, long story short, she tried to explain it to me, but I really couldn't understand it on the phone. So I said, please send it to me, would you? I have no idea what you're talking about. She sent it in the mail. This beautiful, wonderful lady, she's a Catholic nun, loves the Lord dearly, is ministering to the sexually abused and broken in northern part of India. She sends me this certificate of authenticity and this bill that if I showed you, you would see that immediately it was fake, but it says $1 million. I thought, well, that's kind of nice of somebody to do that, but awfully mean. And here she thought, not knowing if it was genuine or not, but the moment I opened it up, I showed Lisa, I said, oh, poor Sister Flora, she's going to be really disappointed. There's no $1 million. It's completely fake. But that was really obvious. What's hard to see is when something is really close to it, but not quite. Do you know when they train people to learn how to tell counterfeit money, they actually don't give them fake bills like this $1 million. They give them real money. And they study and study and study and study what real money looks like. Because in that way, they can see exactly what it is. They feel it. They smell it. They look at the color ribbons or whatever else is in there. And they know it by heart. So the moment something false comes, I know what that is. That's counterfeit. Because if they try to study counterfeit, the variety is endless. But if you know the genuine, you can pick out the false. Well, that's the same way with family and family dynamics that we're going to talk about this morning. We got to understand what the true is, what the real is, to be able to understand where it comes from, what's really on God's heart. And now when I say family dynamics, I'm not just talking about the nuclear family or the extended family, although just statistically, most sexual abuse happens within the extended family, a big, big majority. And it's really hard to get statistics, by the way, because a lot of this is very unreported, goes unnoticed, is hidden under the cover. And you'll see some of this even through the teaching. And then later on, Lisa's going to follow up right before lunch with how this family dynamics affects the abused and the abused culture. But it's oftentimes so under the radar that it's hard to find out. But if we know what God intended, it's a whole lot easier to see it. So right there for you, you've got definition of what family systems is. And family systems, by the way, again, is way more than just our nuclear extended family. It can be in your work. It could be your job, your social life. It can be the buddies you hang out with. There's all sorts of family systems that we come into. And you're going to see this through the examples that we give. But family systems is we all live in these kind of systems. We all have some of them, and they're very powerful. They really define and try to define who we are and what it's all about. So let's look at a healthy system. That's the first part of your notes there. What is really a good system? Well, let's look at some of those things there. It's unconditional love. There's really a place for people to be themselves, to share, to express their emotions and not be rejected. There's a place for that unconditionalness when it comes to grace or sin or failure. There's open or a flexible system. That means There's ways to move in and out, and there's room to grow. There's grace. There's no strict rules. That means that rules can be changed if necessary. So if things need to adapt, they can adapt. There's that freedom to be able to do that, to be able to move around in those different kind of systems. There's freedom and acceptance. There's a real peace there. The aim is for mutual growth. We're really in this together kind of atmosphere. That follows right into mutual respect, where power is used for the benefit of the whole group. There's really respect, love, consideration. People are given freedom. People are given voice. Everything that goes against what we often think of dysfunctionality. There's honest concern or honesty concerning facts and feelings. People are able to share what they really feel like, even if someone disagrees. Even if it doesn't seem the appropriate thing to do, in a good, healthy family situation, whatever system that might look like, you're allowed to disagree. You're allowed to say what you feel. And because of that, the last one, there's that university or unity and diversity. That's where we actually get the word university from, is that combination of unity and diversity. University is really where several colleges go together under this umbrella called a university. But each college has its own unique identity, purpose, structure, so on, within a college system. But that's how we think, you know, that's the picture of university. But if you break that apart, it's really unity in diversity. So you've got the same thing in a healthy situation. You've got the unity called this family unit, whether that's your last name and your immediate family or extended family or certain circumstances of your job or whatever system that might look like. But then there's you're allowed that diversity. You're allowed to be different and yet unified under this umbrella. That's how God intended it. I asked Ruth if she'd read a scripture from Genesis. Would you do that for me? We're going to look at the Bible. I should have warned you there ahead of time, Ruth. Sorry. I told you about it, but I see you put your Bible down. Can you read that out loud for me? Genesis chapter 3, verse 14 through 16. Probably sounds like a strange verse for what I just shared about healthy family systems. But yet often we read that verse and we always think of it as curses. You know, how God cursed man and cursed the woman and cursed the serpent and so on. And yet really there's a blessing behind that verse. That a woman in pain, in childbirth, that something good could come out of that. And the idea is that when two people enter into some kind of painful relationship, but yet they're connected, yet there's that functionality and that healthiness that's meant to be, their pain will actually help bring them together. It helps draw them together. So in a beautiful thing like childbirth, where you have a man and woman, and you have the very essence of what God created for a family unit, in that pain of childbirth is a blessing. Because she needs someone to coach her and hold her hand and help her through the contractions and all those kind of things that take place in childbirth. And yet, they're there and they can concentrate and they can be one. The husband may not be feeling that pain, but he can be there and coach through and walk through and comfort. And yet there's that closeness. And yet if there's an unhealthy family situation, that very same kind of pain can often drive couples apart. Financial pain, separation, all sorts of problems with children, whatever it might be in a marriage or a family situation, that very same kind of pain that could draw people together now wants to separate them. Genesis 2, very familiar chapter or verse for all of you, for Genesis 2, verse 24 through 25. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked, and they were unashamed. There's a real purity, the way God intended, the very basics of family. See, we have to start with the good. Before we dive into all the dysfunctionality that most of us have grown up with in some level or not, or other, we have to understand what God really intended. And he said, I love the King James Version in this case, that a man should leave and a woman should cleave. It's that leaving. The man has to leave his family unit to start a new one. He has to leave his mother and father. And they cleave to one another. And it's that cleaving that says we are now together. And in a healthy, functional system, we're going to face life together. We're not just going to procreate and reproduce ourselves. We are a unit. We are living together. We are one flesh. And so there's a real beautiful thing there that God's created. But the problem is, of course, lots of other pain and situations and circumstances come through, and that's what separates us. In a moment, we're going to look at a thing called the drama triangle. But in a healthy situation, you've got really three main players, and I put them there at the bottom of page 6 there so you can see and kind of reference back, and we'll come back to it in a little bit. But in a healthy situation, you have a healthy authority figure, a father, or it might be a boss in a work situation. You have the autonomous person, a subordinate. He's autonomous and yet not controlled, and yet he's purposely submitting himself like an employee would do to an employer, like children would do to the father or mother. So you have this kind of healthy situation there. And then you have other people that support or become friends or help support that kind of system or that family dynamic. So those are some of the different things that you see in a healthy situation. Now let's turn to page 7. Now you're going to see the dysfunctional, which most of us are jokingly familiar with. And it's really amazing to me when you watch just television in general. I don't know about you, but I make a comment about this all the time with my kids. It's like every time you watch the latest sitcom, it's always bashing the father or the husband. Have you noticed that? It's like the majority of sitcoms, it's either a dope or a doofus, you know, kind of a Homer Simpson sort of father, or it's some kind of nut or you know, guy's got a screw loose or something like that. And so dysfunctionality is very popular, of course, on TV because we can make lots of jokes about it. And we often feel that ourselves. Because that's why we laugh, because we recognize ourselves. We recognize the different characters that are in it. Well, what's the contrasting difference? Dysfunctional systems, there's dysfunctional, or sorry, conditional love in the dysfunctionality of it. There's certain conditions put on it, certain rules and regulations. You must, you should, there's no grace. And you're not allowed to be who you really are. You're only what I need you to be. It's very conditional. It's also a closed system. There's no way out. You're in this. And if you try to get out, you're guilted and manipulated, and we'll look at some of that in a moment. But it's really meant to hold you and confine you, and you have to be what I want you to be. Dysfunctionality in this drama triangle, I'll explain in a moment, screams out, stay here. This is where you belong. You have to be in this system, whether you like it or not. There's also strict rules. There's that guilt and manipulation. This is the way we do it. There's no disagreement. There's no allowing for discussion. It's very, very confined. And as you'll see here in a moment, there's different roles. Instead of the healthy role of the healthy authority, you have the abuser or persecutor. Instead of the healthy role of an autonomous person, you now have the victim. Instead of a friend, you have the helper or enabler. And others will add a fourth category called a passive onlooker, and I'll cover that in a moment. But it's really, that's the dysfunctionality of it. That's the harmful thing of it, is because it's so closed, it's so trapping that they feel like they're stuck in there. So let's look at healthy and unhealthy family situations in terms of the drama triangle. This drama triangle was actually developed or written out, as you were, in the 1960s by Steven Cartman. And you have a little blurb there in your notes about that. But really, it's a way to look at these systems. And we'll contrast this when we finish with the healthy again and end with the healthy system. But as we look at the dysfunctionality, this is really important because all of us get into it. Every single one of us play this. We play it in our families. We play it with two people. You don't need to have three people to play this triangle. As a matter of fact, you can actually play this triangle inside your own head, as you'll see. And a lot of us do it, and we're not even aware of it. But this is key when we talk about ministering to the abused, when we talk about ministering to traumatized, because this isn't just an added little teaching. This is the foundation where a lot of them come from. And Lisa will cover this later, how the whole drama triangle and this whole dysfunctionality sets up the stage for abuse to happen. And it keeps the person in the victim role and keeps the person in that abusive role. And this is so much the games we play. The trouble is most of us don't know what it really is because we don't have anything different. Remember, if we've grown up in a family that's dysfunctional, and every family to some degree is dysfunctional, we understand that. But we're talking about extreme dysfunctionality. We don't know the difference. We don't get it because we don't see the difference. It's all we have because that's all we've grown up with. And so mom and dad's rules or the way that's played is very much the way it is, and we don't know anything else. So again, you have three primary roles in this. You have the persecutor, you have the rescuer, the enabler or helper. There's several different terms that are synonymous there. And then the pivotal role at the bottom, that's why it's at the bottom of the triangle, is the victim. Because everything sort of spins around that like a top. Everything's kind of focused on that one. And as soon as you get into this kind of triangle, we'll talk about how you get into it in a moment. But as soon as you get into this, most people will gravitate to two positions, either the victim or they'll gravitate to the rescuer because that's the comfortable place. Nobody likes to be the persecutor. Even people behind bars that are criminals that need to be there because they truly were the abuser and the persecutor and so on, still try to play the victim. Well, it's not my fault. It's the government's. It's not my fault. It's my mom, blah, 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 and it goes on the list. Everyone tries to be either the victim or the helper because that's comfortable. That's the way we like it. Let me, before I go on to that one, let me just read some of the stuff here at the bottom of this notes. That's why I put it in bold because I really want you to catch this. This is how dynamically entrapping that this drama triangle can be. In a family situation, you are expected to be inauthentic. You're expected to be something, somebody else for someone else. I'm reading right there in the middle. You are not allowed to be in touch with who you are, how you are feeling, and what truly motivates you. In these kind of dysfunctionality, you are meant to be in that place, in that system, because that's where the other person needs you, usually the persecutor. Although you never had a name for it of what you were experiencing. I like that because a lot of times we feel this, but we don't know. We don't have language for it. So we as helpers, we as counselors need to understand and have language for this. First for ourselves, for our own dysfunctionality, and recognize it and recognize how easily entrapped we are. Lisa and I tease each other all the time about this. Oh, you playing the victim again? Oh, are you being the enabler? You know, and it's my turn, yeah. I want to be the victim. And so it's kind of fun because it makes us really realize, oh, yeah, how easy this is that we fall into it. It's amazing. The very last statement there in the bold, the triangle is based on blame and guilt, and it's put into operation whenever any type of lies or denial occur. So this whole triangle is based on blame and guilt. Blame and guilt is what gets you in there. And we'll talk about the shoulds in a moment. But oftentimes phrases like, well, you should have, as soon as puts a blame on someone, it makes them feel like they've got to respond. They've got to comply somehow. And that immediately pulls them into the triangle. So you've got manipulation at the top that goes between the persecutor or the persecutor or the bad guy. There's lots of different terms for that. Between the rescuer, the helper, the enabler. There's manipulation. They're manipulating each other. And I'll give you a demonstration of that in a moment. Let me just finish explaining it. You've got guilt and blame, of course, that enable the whole thing to happen. If you look at between the persecutor and the victim, there's lots of blame, lots of guilt. Well, you should have, and it's your fault that, and there's all sorts of blame. The victim, by the way, can turn either kind of an angry sort of victim or a very pathetic or passive kind of victim. A victim can respond in anger, get really frustrated, mad, and actually turn into the abuser themselves. Or they play a very passive role, and it's the whole world's against me, and it's all their fault, and love to play that victim role. The rescuer, the helper, the enabler, loves the dynamics because they need a victim to feel good. We'll look at that in a moment. But they need someone to help. That's why they're such a key part of this, because they kind of put some fire behind it. Well, I can fix this. I can take care of this. I can help this family. I can, and the list goes on and on. As you notice down there in your notes, I put another rectangle kind of shape one. That's because you notice the top, I had to change it here. The top right-hand corner there is a passive onlooker. Oftentimes people will draw it as a rectangle instead of a triangle, because the rectangle helps add in that fourth person. That's a passive onlooker. But for the sake of our teaching today, I'm just going to stick with a triangle. But a passive onlooker kind of adds that added dynamic, because they're there, they're observing, but they don't do anything. See, the enabler or the rescuer, the helper, will jump in and try to fix things and sort things out. But the passive onlooker can actually be a little bit worse for the abused victim, especially because someone's there, knows the situation, and isn't doing anything about it. So I leave it in there for your notes and just to explain that. And we can have lots of passive onlookers, so it's not just one person, as you can imagine. But it's really painful for an abuse victim because they see the circumstances, they know the dynamics, they see the blame, they see the guilt, they see all this stuff. Why aren't they doing anything about it? Where are you to help me? Why aren't you rescuing me? Why aren't you jumping in? Why aren't you? And the list goes on and on. So that's the different kind of things that you have within that drama triangle. Now we're going to look at the different definitions here by category. So if you turn to your next page, page 9. The victim position is a key role in the triangle. It's one that usually people gravitate to the most. It's the pivotal role. People operating in the victim position take no responsibility for their actions or feelings. Well, it's not my fault. I can't help it if it's that way. That's because my boss will, and fill in the blank. That's because mom and dad won't, fill in the blank. There's always a blame shift. There's always a way to project it on someone else. It's not my fault. I don't need to take responsibility for that. I'm the victim here. Now, for people who are truly victims, those of sexual abuse and others, there are true victims. So when in this terminology, I'm not trying to belittle someone who has been truly victimized. This is the role that we play in a drama triangle where we feel that and express that, and it may or may not be true. So I'm not belittling those who are truly victims of some kind of violence or abuse. But the victim is often that pivotal role. It can be anything and anybody. And by the way, even if you start off in a victim, I'll show you this in a moment in a dialogue I have up here on the PowerPoint, you can actually change within one sentence or with one argument, play the victim at one part, change to the abuser in another, and play the helper or enabler in the other. And you can literally swap around in one argument. Yeah, but you said, well, I didn't do that. And you know, you can just imagine all these kind of where you're flip-flopping all the time. So the triangle becomes very much a dance, and the victim plays that pivotal role. In the triangle, the rescuer. Let's go to that one. In the rescuer, feels like they need somebody. They've got to have somebody to rescue them. There needs to be somebody, that they can rescue. There needs to be someone that they can help. Now, this is a little bit hard for those of us who are mercy gifted, those of us who have a background of counseling or like to help people. Maybe your spiritual gift is mercy, or you know, you have a sensitive spirit, or you like to be a helper. Your spiritual gift is maybe serving. This can be a real danger for us who have those giftings, because it's very easy for us to fall into the role of being the rescuer, of being the enabler, because our natural bend already is to go that direction. And so this, you know, we think we're doing something good. We think that we're helping out. We're probably doing it for the wrong motives. See, for a rescuer who needs somebody to fix, or let me help you, as it says up there, it's really a temptation, because it's really for their motivation so they can feel good. See, if you're in a victim role, you want to get out of that victim role a lot of times. Some people like to play the victim, but then they want to fix a situation so they easily gravitate to become a rescuer, a helper, or enabler, because they're trying to sort this thing out, trying to fix it, trying to help somebody, because then I can feel good. Because a victim is very powerless. I'm this, you know, victim of my circumstances, and there's a very powerlessness feeling for it. So an able to be powerful, you don't want to become the abuser. Nobody likes to be that one. So you gravitate towards becoming the rescuer. Because there I can feel some power. I can fix things. I can change things. I can do things. And that's why the manipulation can oftentimes play into that. So a rescuer needs a victim, and a victim needs a rescuer. The two really go hand in hand. They really turn into can often be a very codependent relationship, very symbiotic, codependent, because they feed into each other's weakness. And the rescuer, especially a Christian, can think they're doing something good in the name of the Lord. Well, I'm really trying to help this person. Well, I'm really trying to sort out this situation. Well, I really want to, and fill in your own blank there. And it sounds good, and I love God, and this person needs this, but it's really so that we feel good. Because if we don't have a victim, you know what happens for the person who's a rescuer? They go find another one, and then they find another one, and they find another one, because that's how they get their life and their energy and their sense of well-being. Most people will choose a favorite place to start in the triangle. Usually it's the victim or the rescuer. They like those two positions because, hey, everybody likes a little bit of pity. Poor me. Help me out. I've got nobody to turn to. Victim, victim, victim. Or, let me help you. Let me jump in and solve all your problems. There's a real difference between being a caretaker and giving care. They're very similar. You know, the line is very thin sometimes between them, but it's a big difference. A caretaker does it for their motivation, for their sense of well-being, for their help. Real care, on the other hand, is to genuinely help someone in their interest, whether you get something back or not. Real care says, I'm doing this out of unconditional love. Caretaking says, what do I get out of this? What's my angle? And see, it can be very subtle between these two different things. Let me give you an illustration. There's a guy named Tom, and he has a good friend named Paul. And Paul is kind of one of those guys who loves to borrow things and never returns them. And if he does return them, it's always a little bit late or broken or bent or something like that. And, you know, Paul's just one of those kind of guys that just doesn't really take care of things. Tom, however, is a real mercy kind of guy. He likes to help people. He genuinely loves people. Things like that. He wants to do what he can. He believes in, you know, do unto others as you will have them do unto you, and tries to live by the golden rule and so on. And so he really wants to help out whenever he can. Now here comes the circumstances. Paul comes back and he says, you know what? My car's in the shop. Yeah, I forgot to put oil in it again. So the engine seized up, and so they're replacing the motor. Tom, can I borrow your car? Now, immediately, Tom's thought is, oh, no, here's Paul again. He's that guy who doesn't return things very well, doesn't use them. He's already messed up his own car. His motor seized because he didn't check the oil, and now I've got to make a decision. Then Paul starts in with his, but Tom, you're my good friend. I really need that car because I've got a job interview tomorrow, and you know I need the money. You know I'm struggling. If I don't get that car... or a way to get down there, I won't be able to make that job interview. So now there's this guilt. Remember, that's what brings us into the triangle, is that guilt and manipulation. Now there's that sense of, uh-oh, I've got to do something about it. Now Tom, because he's mercy-oriented and very wanting to help out, he thinks about it for a while. He kind of bites his teeth, and finally, with great hesitation, he reaches in his pocket, he pulls out the key. And before letting go, he says to Paul, you better get it back to me tomorrow night at 5. I've got to have this, and you take care of it. And he starts putting all these kind of, you know, do this, and you should, and he's trying to make his point known. So now Paul takes the car. 5 o'clock comes, no car. 6 o'clock comes, no car. 7 o'clock comes, no car. Finally, 10 o'clock at night, Paul arrives, knocks on the door. Tom, in great haste and disgust, answers the door. Where you been? Shouting and mad. Paul is, oh, man, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, I got down to that interview, and he goes on to describe the traffic and the problem. And then I met this guy, and he talked about, you know, if I'd hook up with him and we could do this business deal. And so then he invited me out to dinner, and I knew I had to get your car back at 5, but, you know, this was one of those once-in-a-lifetime kind of deals, Tom. And he goes on to explain and explain. Finally, Tom, in his own madness and disgust, is kind of wrestling a little bit there and begins to calm down a little bit. But still feeling that anger, still feeling that frustration, like, no, wait a minute. I was violated. I was wrong. And so he gets in touch a little bit with that feeling, and then he starts in on Paul. Paul, I told you 5 o'clock. I really needed the car back then. You didn't do it. You are so irresponsible. You are so lazy. I knew this was would happen. I knew I should have never given you that car. You see what's happening with Tom now? He's becoming, in the eyes of at least Paul, the abuser. Hey, says Paul, I thought we were friends. Man, come on, cut me a little slack here, Tom. What's going on? I mean, I thought we were friends. I mean, I know you said 5 o'clock, but do you know how important this business meeting was for me? Do you realize what kind of connections I made over dinner? And so now there's this guilt, manipulation. Should. You ought to do this. And they start dancing around this triangle. One's playing the victim at one moment, one's playing the rescuer. One's playing the helper. Paul can respond back, for example, well, it's not my fault. I mean, I couldn't help the traffic coming back. I didn't know this guy was going to ask me out for dinner. He's playing the victim at that point. Second later, he can be accusing, being the prosecutor or persecutor himself, and he can be accusing Tom. Yeah, but I thought we had a good friendship. I thought we had an understanding here. You borrowed stuff from me, and now he can play that role. And so there's a real dance that takes place, even in a simple conversation like that. Rescuers need to be needed. They love to find someone to help. And victims, of course, love to find someone that'll help them. Let's talk about the persecutor, the abuser. This is a role nobody naturally gravitates to because nobody really likes to be that way. Very few will gravitate toward that role. But as soon as you guilt and shame someone, every single one of us will dance around this triangle and take this position eventually. Because of our own emotions, because of that closed system, because you're not really allowed to express how you feel, so therefore you have to just suck it up and be something or someone else for someone else or circumstance. And then after a while, that anger and frustration boils over and out comes the abuser in you. It's not the one that anybody consciously generally chooses to begin with in a triangle. In fact, it's the role that keeps the triangle going, actually, because most people in a triangle are trying to avoid being in the position. They don't want to be the persecutor, the abuser, so they'll try everything to get around it. So that's actually what keeps the triangle going. Now, here's the clincher. If you're a persecutor, you don't want to be that way, so you try to be another role, the victim or passive onlooker or the rescuer, helper. But you know the only way out of the triangle is to become, in the eyes of those playing the game, the persecutor. What do I mean by that? Let me give you the classic example of the drama triangle, and that's an alcoholic father who comes home at night. He's worked all day long. He drinks his life away because that's the only way he can cope with the pain of his circumstances. Mom is the classic enabler, helper. She's trying to soothe everything out and sort everything out so this family feels safe and secure. And the child, unfortunate child, ends up being the victim. So dad comes home. He walks by the child's room. You didn't clean up the room, and slams the door and swears and makes all sorts of accusations. I told you to clean up this bleep, bleep, bleep room, and just with huge anger and violence because he's the abuser. Now, all of a sudden, the child feels the victim. Not my fault, but I and out of breath, but I wasn't even home today. I mean, and trying to find a way to get out of that feeling of being pinned and trapped. Mom comes running over. No, you don't understand, Tommy was, and he was, and tries to sort everything out and smooth everything out. Now, once little Tommy grows up, and he goes, you know what, I'm tired of this family. I'm tired of getting blamed. I am not going to live with this crap anymore. I am tired of dad shouting. I am tired of mom being passive and never stepping in and protecting me. I'm tired, blah, 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 blah. He decides, that's it. I'm getting out of here. And he packs up his bags and he moves out. Guess what happens? Now little Tommy, as he's grown up, has turned into the persecutor. Not because he chose that way, not even because he thinks he's that way, but because he automatically becomes that. So now mom and dad are like, oh, I can't believe it. He's moved out of the house. Do you know what we've given that boy? Do you know how much education? Do you know how much I've paid for him? We took care of his car. And oh, the list goes on and on. And now all of the family's problems get blamed because Tommy moved out. If he hadn't done that, well, then fill in the blank. And there's so much emotion and so much anger. And see, all Tommy did was try to just get out of this system that he couldn't stand anymore. So he packed up and physically, in this case, the classical scenario, left. But in the eyes of those that are still playing the game, he's now the abuser. It's all his fault. He messed up the family system. He moved out. He has no consideration for us. Doesn't he realize how much money we... And fill in the blank. So poor Tommy can't win, or so it seems. And that's oftentimes how the only way out of this triangle is to just, you know, in that classic example, move out. We got to move out emotionally. You know, we'll talk about that in a little bit, probably after the break. But you've got to do things that say, I'm not going to play this game anymore. I'm not going to live by this system. And that's difficult because nobody wants to be the persecutor. Nobody wants to be the abuser. And yet that's the role that they're going to be automatically kind of shoved into once that drama plays out. I think we'll take a break at this point because where I want to go next, I'm going to need a little bit more time. Any questions so far? Yes, Mary. Yeah, the different role ones, yeah. I kind of purposely didn't go through them, but I will per your request because I figured a lot of stuff was repetitious. But thank you. Yes, Tom. Okay, yes, Tom. Oh, very good. What would have been appropriate response to the scenario of Tom being late? Or Paul was late, actually. But what would be the appropriate response Tom would give? In a good, healthy system, the appropriate response is to share your feelings, to be true to who you are, to not cave in. So in a calm manner, in a true manner, Tom's response could have been, Paul, this really hurts because I needed the car back at 5. We agreed at 5 o'clock. I know what you're going to say. You've told me your excuses already. I understand. But in order for us to keep this friendship, in order for us to maintain this, you have to respect me. I am trying to respect you, and this is how you have to respect me. And they lay their boundaries. They hold to the line. They share honestly how they're feeling. See, Tom, in this scenario, in that case, Tom caved in, didn't really share what he was really feeling until he finally erupted, and then he turns into the abuser role, and then the drama triangle keeps dancing around. But the appropriate response is say what you feel, hold your boundaries, and then those people need to conform to that. Otherwise, there's no sense of safety. That's what creates safety. There's going to be those disagreements. There's going to be those clashes. But what creates the safety is when you know where you have someone, where you've got that position where they can relate to each other. It's a good question. Anybody else? Oh, yes. Yes. Tom owned the car and had the keys. You're exactly right. That's exactly right. And had he done that from the beginning, that's exactly right, because then he holds the line. He doesn't have to give in, yeah. So her comment was, just for the recording, the comment was, if Tom had said from the beginning, this is how he felt because of Paul's history of borrowing things and not returning them on time or broken or whatever, had held his line as a friend. He could have reiterated, we are friends, but in this case, I'm not going to give you my key because you have not proven yourself trustworthy and so on. So initially, that would have been the perfect response, correct? Absolutely. And see, that's where that freedom is when it's a healthy situation, because then you are free to express that. There is that love and respect. There is that trust. There is that sense of unconditional love. Paul may not have liked that in that circumstances. He might have gotten mad and stormed off. Okay. If there's a real friendship, he'll be back. And if not, it probably wasn't needed. Yeah. So good comment. Thank you. We're going to take a break till about 1:45 or so.